Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Are you ready? Because Suspense Radio is so glad to have you here on tonight, Tuesday, September the 14th. We got a great show for you coming up. We got authors Joshua Graham and Jennifer Lee Carroll. They're going to be on discussing their books. Also, our SmackDown tonight is going to be a little, we're going to hit the movie side here. So we're going to go James Bond this time. I've been thinking about this for a little while. And I decided I'm going to go ahead and run with it tonight. I'm going to see what people think. Everybody kind of everybody knows James Bond, whether you've seen them all or not. You still know who he is. So we're going to go ahead and we're going to say, is it Sean Connery in the Roger Moore James Bond era, or is it the new modern era with Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig? We know that the series right now is a little up in the air with the selling of the studio. And there's been a couple smacks back and forth between the newer Bonds to the older Bonds, so we're going to go with that one. So I want you to sit back, relax, because 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Well, I can see I'm getting a little bit of stuff from the chat room going on. People love the music. I try to change up every week, maybe make a little theme to what we're talking about here tonight. Really, I just kind of play whatever I feel like playing, just to tell you the truth. So I'm your host, John Robb, here, and I'm flying solo again tonight, which is great. And I want to go ahead and I want to remind everybody that, you know, our show is live every Tuesday and Friday. You can always go back and hear all the archive shows. And I'll tell you, we've had a star-studded September that started out with Lise Wheel and Norm MacFarlane. And last week we also had Brett Battles and William Kent Kruger were on the air, and that was on Friday night shows. You can go back and listen to all of those. There are a couple of ways. You can go to suspensemagazine.com, click on Suspense Radio, and you'll see it there. You can also go to our site here on blogtalkradio.com. Clicking on the Suspense Magazine, finding it that way. Or if you just go to the book section, we're always up in the top three or four. You can click on our show page and go back and listen to the archive shows. We're on Netflix through the Roku. We're on iTunes, 75 other podcasting stations. So there's no excuse to say that you can't hear us and you can't find us. Without any further ado, though, I want to bring on my first guest here, Joshua Graham. And Joshua is the author of Beyond Justice. And we featured his book and himself in the Suspense Magazine just in September here. So, Joshua, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Great. Hey, and I know I was on your radio show, and it's great to see that you and Susan are doing something to also help out the community for books, because there's just not enough of us out there pushing, you know, so the fans, everybody can understand what's going on.
Yeah, it was really a... inspiration that came from Blog Talk Radio with you guys at Suspense Magazine. We thought it was such a cool concept, and we decided we wanted to start some discussions informally, and then it just became something more formal, and now we're actually lining up a whole bunch of guests, and you were among our illustrious guests in our last show as well. But, yeah, we're going to be lining up not just authors, but people in the industry like yourself, agents, hopefully, editors, publishers, publicists, just so that we can just talk about the art, the craft, and the business of writing.
Right, and it's so good to know that I actually inspire somebody, because I think that's amazing. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. What you guys are doing at Suspense Magazine is just an amazing way of supporting writers like us, because you're giving us exposure, and you're also giving us a chance to talk about our books, talk about ourselves, and just get more of our product out there for the general public. And it's something that I can say, I'm sure I speak for all the other writers, that we really appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. I want to let everybody know, if you want to find out more about Joshua, you can do that, maybe while we're listening, is joshua-graham, remember the dash, .com. So joshua-graham.com. And he's going to talk right now. I'm going to ask him, so Joshua, Beyond Justice, can you give everybody a little bit about what it's about?
Well, it's, there are a couple of quick ways to sum it up. Maybe I'll try to say something brief about it before I go into any kind of detail. But if you can imagine the biblical story of the book of Job, a man who, has it all, but then he loses everything. His worst nightmares come true, but in the process, he finds his soul. And this is what Beyond Justice is basically about. It's a reputable attorney who somehow is accused for the rape and murder of his wife and daughter. He's convicted and sentenced to death by lethal injection, and he's wrongfully accused, as I said before. And it's a journey for him, because a good part of it, the entire second act, takes place in a supermax prison. And there, it sounds like kind of a John Grisham-like story, but at the same time, you've got a kind of a Stephen King-ish supernatural twist there, where he starts to manifest some supernatural clairvoyant type of abilities, and these abilities actually help him to survive prison, first of all, which is no small feat, and to actually start to uncover clues that help him find, solve the mystery, the main mystery in the book. But, at the heart of it, it's a story of redemption, it's a story of forgiveness, and it really pushes the concept of forgiveness to the limits, because without saying too much about the book itself, it really forces me as a writer, and hopefully the reader, to really challenge your own preconceptions of your understanding of such concepts of forgiveness and justice and mercy and grace and those ideas.
Now, I'm also noticing that you're doing a virtual book tour, and your tour schedule looks packed from September 7th all the way down here to October 29th, with only a couple days in the middle there. So tell us exactly, how did you think of this virtual book tour, and exactly what is it?
Well, a virtual book tour, and you're right, it is pretty packed. You know, if it were a physical book tour, I think that schedule would have been impossible, because I'm going to a different location just about every single weekday of these 2 months. A virtual book tour, like virtual reality or in the IT field, virtual servers, is basically done on the Internet. And I'm going to be I'm going to be appearing on various blogs and online publications, and doing interviews, they'll be reviewing the book and talking about the book. And it's been very interesting, because even though I haven't had to actually get on a plane and fly to a bookstore or speak at a convention somewhere, I have had to write a lot. And that should be fine as a writer.
And that's good for an author.
Sure it is. But I got to talk a lot about the book, and I fielded very interesting, thought-provoking questions about myself as a writer and about the book. And I strive to be honest in these interviews. So I try to let the readers get an honest idea of who I am and my thinking, my thought process, my values, and about how that pertains to my writing and my book as well.
Now, I do have a couple questions here from the chat room, so I'm going to take this one first. And this came from Terry in Massachusetts. How often did you put yourself in Sam's shoes, and how hard was it to get out?
Well, I think probably if anybody who's read my interviews or talked to me about the book knows that I really did put myself into Sam's Hudson's as protagonist in his shoes in the opening chapters, and that was very difficult emotionally to do because, like I said, the opening crime really is literally my own worst nightmare. I mean, before I wrote the book, I asked different people, you know, what are your greatest dreams? And then also, what is your absolute worst nightmare? And then I thought about that myself, and basically you're walking through a living nightmare of mine. It's not about, like, something bad happening to me, but it's about something horrible happening to my family and I being powerless to do anything about it. So those were the parts where I definitely had to put myself into the protagonist's shoes. There were scenes from funerals and burials, which came directly from my own experiences. In 2003, I lost my mother to Lou Gehrig's disease, and I remember vividly the process of, you know, preparing for the funeral, the burial, even down to some of the details of, you know, it may sound a little crass at this point, but the details of the front loader dumping sand into the grave, you know, because I lingered to the very, very end after everybody had left from the funeral, and it just, that was my cue. I didn't watch that. I had to leave and actually put that into the scene where Sam Hudson is watching the burial of his wife and daughter. So, yes, I put myself very often into Sam's shoes and drew from my own personal experiences. And I did that only because I really wanted to be genuine. I didn't want to, you know, something this important, like the death of a loved one, you know, you don't want to contrive these things. You don't want people to think you're just faking it and all that. But the difficult part of it as a writer is sometimes, especially in the opening chapter, you go into places that you don't even want to imagine in general, but much less the details, the sensory details of what it might be like. So I had to pull myself out every now and then, sometimes when I was in the middle of it, just because I couldn't take the emotions of it. But the nice thing about this book is, for me as a writer, was that there are multiple points of view, so I was able to step out of Sam's shoes and get into a supporting character's point of view as well, so that provides some relief. So that was my long answer to the question. It was pretty frequent that I had to go in and out of Sam's point of view, but I stayed in his point of view, especially at the emotionally gripping moments.
I gotcha. Well, I'll tell you, we have another question here on the chat, and your writing seems so crisp and real. How do you get into the head of your characters?
Well, you know, I've heard, I don't know everything about things like method acting or that, but I know a little bit about it, and just in general.
We do method acting on this show every week.
Especially for the SmackDown, right?
Exactly. And then I know that tonight, I know that I'm echoing a little bit, and I'm not sure why it just happened when you kind of came on. So people are going to get free of me now.
Right.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
No problem at all. Getting in and out of a character's point of view, it was actually easier writing Sam's point of view because it was in first person. And a lot of times what helps me to write it is if I actually read what I've written aloud in first person. Like if you say something aloud, it's hard to say it and not mean it, because if you don't say it with feeling, with conviction, it just sounds really fake. So I had to actually write things that I could actually say out loud as if I were Sam. It's almost like I had to practice acting. I had to imagine his facial expression. I had to imagine his body language, and somehow write that in with words without necessarily showing. Sometimes I did show you he's clenching his fist, or he's, you know, shaking his fist, or his tears rolling down his eye. You know, I would sometimes show that in the words, but somehow that all has to be in the inflection of the prose, so that you could understand that. And so that's basically one of the ways I do. I read aloud. I pretend like this is lines for a screenplay that I'm actually that I auditioned for. So I tried to put myself into...
You're kind of singing in the shower.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, you know, you're kind of speaking it out loud and seeing how it works.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you're kind of singing in the shower where, you know, most American Idol people should do that because then they know they weren't very good. So you're just kind of projecting it and kind of seeing how it works.
Right. Reading aloud is one of the best things any writer can do because it really does help them look at their sentence structure and beyond that, you know, just overall feel and mood.
Well, I have another question here from the chat room. I'm just going to read it off. And is that the ending disappointed me at the same time I loved it. That's the first time anyone's work made me feel that way. So was the ending something you prepared for, or did it just go that way?
You know, it kind of went that way because the ending, you know, we're definitely not going to talk about the ending because it's got to be remained surprise. But I had planned one way, and from the very beginning, I had planned the ending to be one way. And by the time I got to it, by the time I got to really know the characters, you know, when you get to the end of a journey, it's like having gone on a 1 month road trip with people. You start to love and hate them and know everything about them.
God help us.
Nevertheless, right. But nevertheless, at the end, there's this bittersweet feeling of parting because you just know them so well. You've become part of each other's lives. By the time I got to the end of the book, I looked at the ending I had planned from the beginning. I said, no, that just wouldn't work. And I had to do the ending the way it happened had to happen that way. I completely understand why, you know, the reader may have been disappointed about that part, but at the same time, you know, it was also very, I've been told that they understand why it had to be that way. And for that reason, you know, the ending has almost like, in the musical terms, we use the term coda, a little tale to it. It's, you know, one final vision that Sam Hudson has. And, you know, what you're seeing there is a glimpse into eternity, and that is actually kind of a vision that I myself was given at some point at a similar event in my own life. You know, I'm really treading a thin line here of giving away the ending, but suffice it to say that you, if you look at the very last couple of pages, that very last vision, it's really very similar to a vision I once received after a similar event happened in my own life, and you have a little glimpse of my own belief system and theology or whatever else, you know, you might wrap up into that, what you get out of that.
Fabulous. Well, can you give us a little bit about, you know, now that you have Beyond Justice, what are you working on now?
Well, you know, Beyond Justice was the third novel I ever wrote, but the first one that published. I have another book that I'm hoping will be released in the next year or so, and that's a book called Dark Room, and that's a book where the daughter of a Vietnam photojournalist, she experiences supernatural visions, and by means of those visions, she unlocks a conspiracy that a 40-year-old conspiracy that people are still willing to kill for, and it's kind of political in nature. It's got pretty high stakes. It involves, you know, the United States government, the president of the newly elected president of the United States, and a lot of deep family secrets that are uncovered as well. And again, that book is what's called Dark Room. And I'm hoping that we'll see this book released in the next year or so. I'm also working on, I've got several short stories in a similar vein of in genre, which I hope to release in a collection. And as with my other pen names, I'm constantly working on things. So I've got multiple irons in the fire.
Now, I'm glad you brought up the pen names. Why exactly do you use more than one name?
Sure. Pen names are, you know, basically it's for business reasons. There's no real artistic reason for it. It's just very practical. Because I write in different genres. You know, under Joshua Graham, you see suspense thrillers or supernatural suspense. But if I were to, say, write something like a romance book, like Nicholas Sparks or, you know, then right away people would wonder, you know, or if they didn't even know, if they pick up the book expecting a thriller, and then they turn the page and realize, this is a romance, I don't want this. That will really dilute my market, that would really disappoint my readers and confuse the market. So I believe the most compelling reason for appending is just to organize my work so that if people pick up a Joshua Graham book, they know what they're going to get. If people pick up another pen name of mine book, they're always going to get that kind of book, or speculative fiction or historical fiction. If you go to McDonald's, you're expecting a Big Mac, not sushi. And if you go to Benihana's, you're expecting, you know, some really good Japanese food, not a burrito. Basically, if I consider myself like an owner of multiple franchises, I want to make sure that my product is very, very clearly delineated and marketed appropriately.
Now, I think you're the first author that's actually explained it that way, because there's some other authors that have done it, but they don't really explain it. So I love that explanation. That's fabulous. Yeah, they have it. They're just like, oh, I don't know. You know, kind of like the whole Stephen King, Richard Bachman thing, where he wanted to write as Richard Bachman just because he wanted to see if people were buying his stories or if they were buying his name.
Well, yeah, and in some ways you can consider that market research as well.
Right. So would you say that the Joshua Graham name is probably your most favorite and going to go on the longest, or are you just going to write all of them and just keep on going?
I have no plans to stop any of them. I definitely have a lot of plans for Joshua Graham. That book, Darkroom, that I just kind of pitched to you over the
yeah.
phone, is really the first of a series of books. I've already written outlines and written out the proposals for about four sequels for the Darkroom series. So Darkroom is just the first of at least four books that I want to write, the five books that I want to write in that series.
So that's good. You already got five of them already laid out.
Mm-hmm. At least for Joshua Graham. That's not to mention my other, at least two or three more pen names.
I tell you, I don't know how you do it, juggling them all. I applaud you for that one, I got to tell you.
Well, we writers just have to write, and that's what we do. But the cool thing about writing, a career in writing, is that it doesn't really feel like work at all. I mean, I think there's a Chinese proverb that says, you know, find something to do that you're passionate about and you'll never work again. I mean, it is work, but, you know, it doesn't feel like
it's
work.
Fun.
Yeah, and it's very fulfilling.
Okay, so I want to try to map this together as MapQuest. Because you grew up in Brooklyn, then you went to Maryland, and which is where John Hopkins is, you got your doctorate, then you taught in West Virginia, now you live in San Diego, but you're a member of the Oregon Writers Network. Can you kind of connect the dots a little bit on how did all that happen?
Well, if you follow some of the more detailed biography, then you have to go to Egypt, Jordan, South Africa.
Oh, my Lord. Where in the world is Carmen San Diego? He's with Joshua Graham.
I live in San Diego also. But, well, you know, I pretty much grew up in Brooklyn until my mid-30s, and actually my early 30s. And I did my bachelor's and master's at Juilliard, and then I went to Maryland at Hopkins. Now, down in Baltimore, I'm not too far from, I think it's called the Eastern Panhandle or something like that. And it's a juncture between West Virginia, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. And so all those schools were kind of radiating around Baltimore where I lived. So I taught in those schools as a way of supporting myself while I did my doctorate degree. And there was a lot of driving, but each one of those schools was within about an hour and a half, 2 hours drive. So that's how I got around all those places. And all those Middle Eastern and South African places that I mentioned were where I toured as a musician. And the Oregon Writers Network is a place that Dean Wesley Smith and Catherine Christine Rush teach masterclass. And I've attended that and become a member of that network. They're located up in Lincoln City, Oregon. So that's just the name of this network of writers that are, you know, spread out through the United States and some even internationally. And being a member of that has just been the greatest boost for me as a professional writer.
Well, Joshua, I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Beyond Justice and then talking about your next book, Dark Room, and everything else that you're going to be doing. And I want to remind everybody that Joshua Graham, find out more information. You go to joshua-graham.com to find out about Beyond Justice and his virtual book tour. He is slamming it out there with all that. And you can also buy a book right from his website and everything else. So that's joshua-graham.com. But I do know that, Joshua, you are going to hang around for the SmackDown.
Absolutely.
Is that, So I'm going to put you back. I'm going to put you on hold here.
Okay.
And I'm going to bring on our next guest, which is Jennifer Lee Carroll. And Jennifer is the author of Haunt Me Still, which is out now, which is the sequel to the Shakespeare Curse, which I find just absolutely fascinating from reading about what this is. So, Jennifer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And so I'm sitting here fascinated about the book Haunt Me Still and your book The Shakespeare Curse, because I can't, you know, there's been a lot of things about curses. You have, you know, King Tut, you have the Hope Diamond, you have everything else, but no one has written a book or a series right now that you have where actually the curse is within a play. Could you explain a little about that?
Yeah. Well, I want to make one little correction, which is that The Shakespeare Curse is actually the same book as Haunt Me Still. It's a British title.
Oh, okay. My fault.
That's all right. The first book in the series is called Interred with Their Bones. So it's another curse-like title, but, you know.
Okay. And then I see The Shakespeare Secret, so that's just another edition of the UK. They just changed it.
Yeah. The UK likes to title my books differently.
Wow. Okay.
Don't worry.
I guess that's why they're over there and they lost the war way back when anyway. So.
Okay. Very confusing.
They couldn't even get themselves right.
I can talk about why the titles are different a little bit later. But Haunt Me Still is about an actual curse, if you believe in such things, that a lot of people, especially in the theater, do believe haunt the play Macbeth. That is, you know, Shakespeare's play, Macbeth.
Right.
There are a lot of taboos around producing that play. And this really fascinates me. I have a lot of friends in the theater, and a lot of them who are otherwise rational, even skeptical people, believe in this. You can't quote that play, name it lead characters in a theater beyond what's absolutely required for performance and rehearsal. Without sort of calling down all kinds of catastrophe on your head and on the entire production.
So let me start with that so I understand. So you're saying that if someone's doing the play Macbeth,
right,
and they try to change it around a little bit into doing something else, that there could be disaster that comes out from that.
No, it's not about changing it. It's about quoting it as if the play itself is an evil spell. So you're allowed to quote it as much, you know, to actually perform it. But if you quote it in a theater just to sort of hand off a quote, or you're going to play, you know, the actors play games with each other all the time, throwing out quotes here and there. You can't do that with Macbeth. Even you can't say it if you're, you know, you can't extra quote lines in a rehearsal for Macbeth. You can't quote Macbeth in a rehearsal for something else.
So you can throw Macbeth in with Hamlet?
No, you can't.
Okay. Okay.
I mean, in the theatrical world, that play is treated as if it is an actual dark spell that may call down all kinds of unknown evil into the world. And I just find that, you know, amazing. And it seems to, I mean, there are lots and lots of anecdotes in the theatrical world about actual disasters that have happened when people have quoted the play either accidentally or on purpose to sort of prove that that curse isn't there.
I'd probably do it twice just to see if anyone happens. You know, I'm the dodo who looks in the mirror for Candyman and sees that somebody's going to come. So I'd probably go do it just for the heck of it.
Well, you know, I mean, even really great actors have sort of disaster stories around them. Olivier had one, and he was almost killed once in a... I think it was the first time he performed Macbeth in the lead role. He was standing on stage and he moved, and seconds later, something like a 2,000-pound counterweight came down and just smashed on the floor right where he'd been standing. And Charlton Heston has another great one. Well, I don't know if he thought it was so great, but he was playing in a production where he rode a horse on stage, a real horse. And somebody seems to have poured kerosene on his hose. And the friction of riding the horse with the kerosene in the hose gave him serious burns. So he had to ride the horse off off stage and sort of leap off and cry out, get these off me, get these off me. And no one ever found out who, you know, who played that sort of rather awful and cruel trick. And in the theatrical world, of course, somehow that is part of the evil inherent in the play. And then the other one that I love is for a couple of months before his assassination, Lincoln was obsessed with the play Macbeth. Read it over and over, quoted it aloud. And then
we all know what happened to him.
Right, in a theater.
Of all places, by an actor.
Yeah. So you know, people take it seriously, and I find that really interesting. Because my character, Kate Stanley, she's a theatrical director. She's a young American who works in London, primarily in Shakespeare. And she's a very rational and skeptical person. And I really wanted to, in my head, this is a series of three books that each deal with a Shakespearean mystery. And let me say, first of all, that you don't have to know anything about Shakespeare to have fun with these books. If you know that he wrote a play called Macbeth, you'll like this book, or you'll be able to understand it. That's the extent of your Shakespearean knowledge that you need.
Good, because that's about what I got.
No, seriously, I did that on purpose.
Okay.
you didn't need to know Templars to read the Da Vinci Code. Well, it's similar with my books. You don't need to know Shakespeare, but you'll learn something about Shakespeare if you read them.
Okay.
So anyway, Kate's this young director, and I wanted to give her this sort of mystery around Macbeth, which has partly to do with this curse. But I wanted to push myself, and I wanted to push Kate and put her in a place where, being a very sort of rational, skeptical person, she walked into a scenario that really pushed her to the envelope, really made her start to think, is there such a thing as supernatural power, supernatural evil? Do I have to deal with this? Or am I just going crazy? Or is this somehow some deranged kind of human evil? And I really wanted to ride that line, push Kate down that line, hopefully my readers down that line, and stay in a gray area so that it can be interpreted in a number of different ways. I think the best kind of ghost stories and horror stories do that. And Macbeth is essentially the first great modern horror story. It's got a lot of eerie weirdness going on in that play, and yet there's certainly enough human evil there to explain everything, if that's the way you want to explain it. So I was trying to sort of continue in that vein with this book. The weird thing about that play, which opens it up for a treasure hunt thriller like this one, is that we know that the play as we have it, the play that came down to us in print, is not the play as Shakespeare first wrote it. Somebody has messed with it, and what they messed with, scholars are pretty sure, is the witches and their magic. And so, frankly, we don't really know what exactly Shakespeare wrote, and we don't really know exactly how or why it was changed or when. And that leaves, for someone who likes historically based thrillers, that leaves some wonderful moments of I don't know in there for a novelist to really get in and say, well, let me make it up.
Yeah, because let me think, because if I'm right, Shakespeare's in the 1400s?
He's in the 1600s.
1600s, okay. 1400s was probably the Templars. I probably got him confused. So, so he was in the 1600s. Excuse me. So your book is is basically a historical fiction of the play as in a fictional setting where you take the character. Now, are you saying, now, so does the character go around and are you looking for the actual manuscript, or is it looking for the where the curse came from? Are you doing both?
So most of the play, most of the book is set in the modern time. There are a few scenes set back in Shakespeare's time. And what happens at the beginning of this, and this is just books, the beginnings of books just come in my head full blown. And what happened to me is I was at on top of Dunstan and Hill in central Scotland, which is a place that was it's the ruin of an Iron Age fortress. And then the real Macbeth rebuilt it. And now it's just a big, beautiful green hill in the middle of nowhere. But I was standing on the top of that hill, and I just had the vision of Kate coming up there one morning in beautiful, bright sunshine and falling asleep up there. And this hill is also reputed to be a fairy hill, which means all kinds of weird things. There are legends of all kinds of weird things happening up there, like people disappearing, strange things happening to animals. And this goes way far back in history. So I had this dream of Kate falling asleep, which is, in Celtic legend, a no-no on a fairy hill. And then the Scottish weather changes, as Scottish weather does.
Right.
She wakes up in gray mist, and she's hearing the wind, which really does whip up over that hill, and it can sound almost like a human voice if the wind is right. And had this vision of her waking up, and it's eerie. She thinks she hears horses in the distance, and then she sees this glint in the grass at her feet, and there's a knife. It's the shape of an ancient Celtic knife. She bends down to pick it up, and a little bit beyond that, she sees a young woman in Renaissance dress. As she gets closer, and she sees that this woman has been ritually murdered, apparently while she was asleep on the hill. And I didn't know when I first had this vision come into my head, is this a dream? Is she really finding a real body? Is somebody staging something for her? I essentially had to write the book to find out.
Wow. So you did a lot of research going back. I mean, you probably had to go back and, research a lot about the curse and the play and, Shakespeare and everything else around you, which, took up a lot of time. So really, how long in the process have these books been coming?
Well, this one was supposed to be done really quickly in 18 months, but right after my first book came out, It's Heard With Their Bones, mm-hmm. my son came along. So he's now almost three. So that slowed down my writing process more than I anticipated, which, other mothers and young children just laugh at me when I say that. I thought I had budgeted extra time for a baby, but...
I got four.
You ain't
budgeted nothing yet. I got four. Are you kidding me? Okay. And if you were a golfer, guess what? Your score went from, if you were shooting in the 70s into the 90s. Everything just gets turned around.
Yeah. So, but, he's wonderful, and I wouldn't trade it at all, but it certainly has... I've had to relearn how to write and how to... let it take longer, or how to make it shorter and not use, how to write in a shorter time, but not skimp on the details, which I don't want to do. But about research, I love research. I have a friend actually who writes biographies who says somebody once asked her, why don't you get a research assistant to help you? And she just looked at him and said, that would be like paying someone to have sex for you. That's the fun part.
And now that you got kids, you might have to do that. Because you ain't got time for nothing no more. But I understand. But that is a great answer. I never thought of it that way. Yeah, where would all the fun go?
Yeah.
Yeah, because half the fun is that's kind of like putting your presents on Christmas, let someone else do it and say, oh, here's what you got. Well, half the fun's unwrapping it. Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, I have a couple of some questions here from the chat, and so I want to read them up here. And have you ever written a book that could be used at Harvard, for example, something on the craft of writing? Because, in your background, you went and you got your PhD from English at Harvard, and you did your undergraduate from Oxford and Stanford, so I think that's probably why they asked that.
I haven't ever written on the craft of writing itself, but my first thriller, Interred with Their Bones, has a large part of it is set at Harvard. which I really had fun with. And I like to think that actually all three of my books, my two thrillers and my nonfiction, could be used in college classes anywhere, not necessarily Harvard, because I think my two thrillers have interesting takes on Shakespeare and the sort of things that have happened to Shakespeare in his plays through history and the way people have thought about them. And my other one, my history, is about it's about smallpox and the discovery of inoculation. And I think that I have spoken about in public health settings. So yeah, I think all my books in some ways are intellectual enough to bear being put on a college curriculum for various different reasons, some of them tongue-in-cheek.
And you know what? I am a big advocate, and I get on the soapbox here for 30 seconds because you know what? They're going to, and I know the people that are listening have heard this before, but is that books like yours, I mean, to bring up the topic of Shakespeare and Macbeth and just the fabulous writing that you do and the intellectual side of everything that you have, why can't high school students, let's just say high school students, why couldn't they use your book in their literature classes instead of going back, way back into the past, and bringing out old books that they're not interested in, that they don't like, it turns them off of reading, or something like your book they could sit down and read in a mystery, you know, mystery and suspense class, and it would turn them on to reading? Why can't those people get their heads out of the sand and realize that there's so many great authors of today that need to be looked at instead of going back and looking always at the past?
Well, you know, I know there are high school teachers out there who have used my book in tandem.
Good. I want to put my kids in that high school because I'm tired of the books that I have to read for them.
Well, you know, I taught Shakespeare at the college level, and I've done a little bit of teaching at the high school level. And I always try to make it alive now, even if I was teaching older literature. So if we were, you know, if I was teaching Shakespeare, I tried to get a book like mine that has Shakespeare set in a modern story, or get people to the theater and see a live production. I think it's really important to make literature, both modern literature and classic literature, alive to students.
You guys spent so much time bringing a story to life that, you know, you put countless and countless hours in, and blood and sweat and tears. You know, why? I don't understand the fact of, you know, what is wrong with today's literature that is they just think is so much worse or whatever than back then. I just don't get it. I'll never understand it, and I'm very disappointed that they have not gotten it yet, I guess, is my point.
Yeah. Well, some haven't. So we'll just keep our fingers crossed that it gets better.
But, you know, I have a great question on the chat here because it's always something that I always try to touch on, too, is, you know, always the marketing of your books and what authors always have to do with it. So one of your fans want to know, how many hours a day does Jennifer write versus how many hours do you spend on the business of writing?
You know what? I write full-time. And by that I mean I am a full-time writer. I'm not very good at saying, today I will write for 3 hours and I'll do business for 3 hours. I try to do as much as possible, I try to keep the business to one day a week because my business brain and my creative brain are very different things and they interfere with each other. I do better by trying to divide it out in the week rather than day to day. But I am a full-time writer, and in the heat of real creativity or in the panicky run-up to a deadline, I'm a more than full-time writer. So I'm burning the candle at both ends and trying to stay up late after my son's asleep and get up early and get things done. But I was listening in on Joshua before, and that is... it's a great blessing. I have a career that I love, and it is work, but it's something I'm passionate about. It's something I love to do. There's nothing more amazing than being in the zone with a novel playing out like a movie in your head, and you feel like you're taking dictation, and you know these characters are doing and saying things that now that you didn't outline, that you didn't, you know, specifically set down for them to do, but they've come to life, and you're sort of their mouthpiece. That's what it feels like, and that's a really amazing sensation.
Well, everybody, time just flew, Jennifer, and we've been working here with Jennifer Lee Carroll. Now, you can check out her website. It's Jennifer Lee, L-E-E, and Carroll, which I just found out, is spelled C-A-R-R-E-L-L. Thank you, Jennifer, for calling me earlier today and saying that I misspelled your name. So that's Jennifer Lee, L-E-E, C-A-R-R-E-L-L. And you want to check out her book here in the States, Haunt Me Still. And I know that we have a lot of UK listeners and people in Europe. And the book over there is called The Shakespeare Curse. Same book, different title, different cover. But I do believe that everybody should definitely pick this up and buy it and see what it's about, because I know I got goosebumps hearing about it, and I can't wait for, you know, the show to go on Netflix and iTunes, where we get, you know, our 10, whatever, thousands of people that we get to download this and listen to it, because it is definitely a very, very interesting topic, especially for people who are just into that mystery and looking for those types of things. So, Jennifer, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your book, and I know that you're ready to talk about the SmackDown, because I did give you a little bit of what it was going to be, and I always changed, Johnny, and I said, you know, that'd be wrong to do. So, everybody, you know what time it is.
I'm only giving you instructions in the dressing room. I expect a tough, clean fight. Protect yourself at all times. The greatest of the challenges. Get it on!
All right, I got Joshua back here on the line, and I'm Jennifer Weston. We are going to talk James Bond in the SmackDown. So tonight, it is Roger Moore and Sean Connery, the movies that they did, The Goldfinger, Live and Let Die, Man with the Golden Gun, Dr. No, against Pierce Brosnan and Daniel Craig, Casino Royale, Quantum of Solace, The World is Not Enough, Die Another Day. Which set of Bonds were better? And Joshua, I'm going to go to you first.
All right. For me, those would be Sean Connery. He's just
Sean Connery, Roger Moore?
Yeah. Not Roger Moore so much. I mean, you know, Roger Moore is suave, he's cool, but he's just not quite as manly as I, as Sean Connery, in my opinion. And the new guy, Daniel, he's cool, but he's a little bit too emo for me. So.
Okay, Jennifer.
You know, I don't know how much the SmackDown is going to be, because I got to go with Sean too, and I would take Sean Connery without Roger Moore. There is something so amazingly sexy about Sean Connery at any age.
There we go.
Yeah, there you go. I know. He managed to be manly, sexy, and, you know, obviously an extremely accomplished killer in those films. But the Sean Connery films had a sly sense of humor that I think has been missing from just about every other incarnation.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm disagreeing with both of you. And here's the reason why, and I'm a huge James Bond. I got every single movie ever done. And I keep up to date on everything. But when you read Ian Fleming and you read the books, Who James Bond Is, Daniel Craig and Pierce Brosnan are what the closest to what he wrote and what he wanted. Because Quantum of Solace and Casino Royale is where James Bond is at his most ruthless and not his funniest, where you hear the kind of cracks from Roger Moore and Sean Connery. Love those movies. Love A View to a Kill. Love Spy Who Loved Me. You know, grew up watching those in the movie theaters. But now knowing what James Bond is supposed to be, I go with Pierce Brosnan and I go with Daniel Craig. Just on the aspect of the actor, not necessarily maybe the movie, but as the actor.
Yeah, you know, I'd say if the question is who sort of best matches Ian Fleming and Ian Fleming's idea of Bond, I'd probably go with you. Go with Daniel Craig, except he looks wrong. But, you know, he's supposed to be dark and slender and
Well, you guys might know, we did not mention Timothy Dalton, and I believe... And the other one is Osby. I forget his first name, but he was in Your Majesty's Secret Service. Right, George Osby.
Your Majesty's Secret Service. Here.
Right. But, like we talked Jennifer Albert, you know, Timothy Dalton turned the role down, and they gave it to Sean Connery.
You know, but Sean Connery's become, he made of that character something that is larger than life, and I think even larger than Ian Fleming's book.
Is it because he was the first? Do you think it was because he was the first?
I don't think so, because, you know, the very first James Bond movie I saw, most of them were all the, with Roger Moore. So when I started to watch the ones with Sean Connery, I felt like, wow, this is much more like what I, you know, what I would prefer.
Yeah, I thought that there's, I mean, Sean Connery did something special with that character and that role that maybe isn't what Ian Fleming wanted or originally wrote, but I think it's pretty fabulous.
Well, I know I'm going to be wrong today, and I'm going to go ahead and say that probably Sean Connery and Roger Moore, I'm going to give it to them on that one, but I'm not going to do it lightly. But I will say, go ahead and probably, I disagree, but that's what the SmackDown's about. The chat room kind of agreed with you guys that it was, you know, Sean Connery and Roger Moore, so... There you go. But it's always fun talking about it. Why not? Well, I'll tell you what. Joshua and Jennifer, I want to thank you guys so much for coming on. That's Joshua Graham. That's joshua-graham.com for Beyond Justice. And that's Jennifer Lee, L-E-E, Carroll, C-A-R-R-E-L-L.com. So, guys, thank you so much for coming on tonight. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So I want to, again, I want to thank all the listeners for joining us tonight, too, on this great show to talk with Joshua and Jennifer. And I want to remind everybody that on Friday we have coming up Juan Gomez-Arado, who is actually going to call us from Spain. And he's getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to call us in Spain. So you better be here and listen to him, because he's a great author, international best-selling Moses Expedition, along with the creator of Rambo, David Morrell, who's going to talk about his newest book, The Naked Edge, and why he decided to publish it the way that he did. So you have SuspenseMagazine.com. We are our print subscribers, you know. We have to come out, get us, check us out on order the magazine. You can get it electronically. You can get a print. And, again, on Friday, you can hear us here with David Morrell and Juan Gomez-Arado, which I'm sure I'm saying his last name wrong. And so find us on Facebook and on Twitter and all over the place. And, you know, keep up to date on what we're doing and what's going on, because we have a lot of great stuff coming up for everybody. And so it's been great, and I really appreciate it. And so... This is John Robb for Suspense Radio. We're going to see everybody Friday night again. So until then, thanks a lot.